Okay, so well, I would like to hear what you've heard. You know, in the canon, or it says, "Thus have I heard." Or I guess I would like to hear what you've heard in what I've said, or any comments or questions. Maybe I will have a response, maybe I won't, but it would be nice to hear from you. And if you could just say your name and then, yeah.
So I was really interested, at some point you said, how are we going to resist institutional forms of violence? With a Dharma practice, how can what forms do those resistance take? And,
yeah.
You know, my personal story is a lot about constantly fighting injustice and campaigning, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
How can I bring a Dharmic attitude, or, yeah, how can I do it in a different way?
Well, I think that there's a lot of levels. Mm-hmm. I think, did everybody hear the question? Yeah. So, I think there are a lot of levels. I think, first of all, we have to be stable. This is really important, because anger is amazing. The best part of anger is that it's mobilizing. Anger mobilizes people, and in that respect, it's healthy. And where anger is not so healthy is where it has in it the intention to harm. So in activist worlds, people who are angry, they know how to get people together and make things happen. But they don't get anything done because they can't collaborate. And we're in an age where the only way to get things done is collaboration. And so I think one of the great things we bring to issues like social justice is a sense of calmness and stability. Secondly, we, I think as Dharma practitioners, hopefully, over time, learn how to not get fixed in rigid viewpoints. So that's another piece that I think is really, really important. Also, and someone who's done a lot of work in this area is a guy named David Loy, is that we have to recognize that it's not enough just to work on our own greed and our own anger and our own delusion. We also have to see that those same energies are working in institutions. And one way that I understand the practice of nonviolence is not cooperating with institutional forms of the three poisons. The other way I understand nonviolence is that I think, and this gets back to the tale, is that I think we also owe it to give a voice to what doesn't have a voice. Whether that's a river or a piece of land or somebody in the culture that we marginalize. So I think those are some basic ways that we can begin to look at our practice through the lens of having a kind of more social effect. So I hope that's a start in a 2-minute response. Did you have your... Yeah.
Yes.
What's your name?
Emily.
Yeah, try and pick one.
I suppose I like that the principles you've outlined of stopping and practicing embodying aren't prescriptive in how they affect the choices that you make with how you spend your time or, you know, the livelihood that you choose.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you know, I feel that there is an urgency to, for example, climate change.
Yeah.
And that my practice alone it's having an impact on me, but I could be doing more, you know, I could be more radical than I am in the choices that I make.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just wondering, how those principles bring to bear on actually, you know, how much is enough for us to do?
Yeah.
What do we really need to do?
Yeah. Yeah. We never feel like we're doing enough. Doesn't matter what kind of helping work you do, the lineups are always increasing. You know, in Mahayana Buddhism, there's this idea of the Bodhisattva vow. You may have seen, especially in Japanese iconography, Bodhisattvas always have a lot of arms. And in every arm, there's always a tool. Maybe the tool is an eye, or an ear, or scissors, or a cell phone, and I think, like, to be bodhisattvas, which is to recognize that our enlightenment includes other people, we have to have tools. And because different people have different tools at different stages of their life, their form of activism is going to look very different. So maybe for a while someone's work was to chain themselves to bulldozers. And maybe a few years later their work is to be at home and be really present with their kids. And maybe someone else is to make poetry. And maybe someone else is a lawyer. And then maybe after 10 years... See, this is the Buddhist piece, is you also can identify with your role. So maybe after 10 years you've been doing one practice and then maybe it doesn't work anymore and you have to try something else and choose another tool. So that's one piece. We also have to link up with other people. And lastly, I think we have to watch that voice in us that says we're not doing enough. Because I think it's tremendously unhelpful. And it tends to take us out of our life and look at it through this idealized lens of what enough is. And I think we really need to watch that. I think that if you have some sincerity in your practice, which mostly comes from suffering, then you'll get motivated to help somehow. And I think you need to be open to what tools you're going to use depending on what ingredients you have in your life at the time. May I say one more thing about that? I hope this is connecting with what you're saying, which is that when you practice, you become a more sensitive person. And you become more sensitive to dukkha. I know that some of us learn the Dharma as being free of dukkha, but it's just not my experience. My experience is that when you practice, you become more sensitive to suffering. And when you become more free, you also become more sensitive to the pain of other people. And when you start to really see that paradox, that the more free you are, the more deeply you're connected to the pain of other people, the only response is to roll up your sleeves and go to work. And this is the secret to happiness, is serve people. This is the secret. When you have all your needs met, there's only two things left to do. Take really good care of yourself and help people. What else are you going to do? Renovate your kitchen? Again? and then you get happy. Because then you don't feel so lonely anymore. And you might think, "Oh, I'm going to just hang out with suffering people?" Yeah. So, good luck. Let me know how it goes. But I really want to avoid prescriptive language. Like, if you're going to help, this is what you should do. Because I just don't think that... I think that's really oppressive. So, yes? What's your name?
Maria.
Maria.
Hi. I'm just wondering if you could give some examples of new storytelling, something that you feel really embodies what you mean by unrestored anger.
Well, in Canada and the United States, the big issue these days are pipelines. Our governments love pipelines. And so one pipeline is supposed to go from Alberta in Western Canada to the coast. It's been totally stopped, primarily by indigenous groups. There was a pipeline that was supposed to go down south. The American government says, we need a pipeline because then we won't rely on foreign oil. But the truth is, the pipeline goes to the Gulf of Mexico, and as soon as it comes out of that pipe, it gets sold on the international market. It's not for the United States. This pipeline that runs through North Dakota goes over one of the largest aquifers in North America, which is the water supply to an enormous area for agriculture. And the two groups who live on this land and have stake in this land are two groups who have never got along. The right-wing farming community and indigenous groups, First Nations groups. So they decided to get together on this issue. And they called themselves Cowboys and Indians. It's like an amazing branding story. And they've done more to stop that pipeline successfully than any other group. Why? Because two groups who are have completely different worldview recognize that on this one issue, they agree. And so I think that's really important. And that's what I mean by collaboration, is that, we all get into our club and we want to be in our club. And we have to recognize sometimes that other clubs, even though we might not be into that club, might actually care about an issue in a similar way. And we can collaborate with them. But it means we can't hold on to our view of what it's supposed to look like. So, maybe that's an example of a story. Did I tell you I'm giving a talk tomorrow night? Tomorrow night I'm giving a talk, and the topic is 12 new stories. And it's going to be 12 new stories that we can tell about our place in the world. There's also a video of it, because I gave it 2 weeks ago and someone filmed it. So you can skip the talk and just watch it on YouTube. Yes? What's your name?
It's Flora.
Flora, okay.
I've just finished training as a storyteller, so I'm
a really storyteller, okay.
To hear the emphasis you put on imagination, the importance of that.
Yeah.
And I wondered if you'd come across the work of Joseph Campbell.
Yes.
I don't really have anything to say after that except lots about him.
Yeah.
But the creation of a new myth that we need to sort of create a story that our modern nation can ride around. We've really lost our way in that. But similar to you, I think the question is the form in which this story can be created but also heard. Because we don't seem to have, in the same way that we've had in the past, a sort of moral compass that everyone looks towards, like religion.
Yeah. Yeah.
The commercial giant that is now the centre of our society doesn't say stories that are nourishing or true, really.
Yeah. So don't look there for the story.
No, exactly. Yeah.
Because you know that one already.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's no real question in this. I'm rambling around, but I think that is so true and wonderful.
Well, I think I could respond, and I'm sorry I forgot your name, but you said something similar along these lines at the break about psychoanalysis and storytelling, and I won't repeat the question, but maybe I can just talk for a minute about stories,
I think. Yeah.
And also, I was asking it in relation, I wasn't saying you did it, but I was saying that quite a lot of drama teachers denigrate storytelling, or the idea of telling our story, our personal story. And so I asked you about whether you had completed your psychoanalytic training, whether you had practiced as a psychoanalyst around that idea of storytelling, and whether I was just thinking of it just a minute ago. You were speaking. Yeah. I had another teacher who had a completely different view of stories, which was that she felt to know and learn and understand our own story was useful because it was the story, if you like, that closed the fist inside of us. If we had a closed fist or something, if we had some. And that in order to open everything inside of us, we had to sort of learn the command, if you like, that got the fist closed.
Yeah.
And then the command that, I don't make any sense, the command that then will enable you to open it.
Interesting.
And that was part of understanding your own story.
Right. Right.
And that was a long practice.
Yeah. Wow, those are amazing. You should be just speaking more, both of you. But because it's my night, I will. But hopefully we can talk at the end as long as I'm in bed at night. So my understanding is when in psychology, and all of us are psychological, whether you've trained in psychology, we're all very psychological. And when we're in meditation practice and content arises, you know what I'm talking about? When content arises, we tend to focus on the content. We tend to look at the content. Maybe an uncomfortable sensation arises in the sternum. Oh, my breath is, you know, stuck here. I have anxiety. And then you get anxiety because you've got anxiety. And then, oh, this is related to what, you know, he said to me. And, right? And so one of the interesting things about contemplative practice is that it's a completely different approach. You could even say it's a cross-cultural perspective on content, which is that in meditative practice, when content arises, we don't look at the content. We don't look at the content. And instead, we focus on the mechanism of the arising and passing away of content. And that takes a long time to look at that. And if you miss that piece, mindfulness practice increases your self-consciousness. Because you start paying attention to your experience as your experience, and you become more self-conscious, actually. You see? So it's really important early on, I think, to make sure that you're putting the psychological mind to the side. And what happens, I think, is when we focus more on the arising and passing away of content and not on the stories start to seem less important. And the ones that are important, they don't go away. But we start seeing stories just as stories. And when a space clears, and this is what we call insight, I think, is when you start to see the way you've been telling a story. And then you could argue that that's a new story, and I would argue that that's your Buddha nature. Is that your imagination has sprung to life and you've been able to now tell a story from another perspective. And while my training also includes exploring concentration practices where we often come to the end of language, it's temporary. And then we come back into storytelling. So let's embrace storytelling, but at the same time be very vigilant about the ones that are repetitive, if this makes sense. So I like to create a kind of like spectrum where on the one hand you have addiction and on the other hand you have imagination. And addiction is when you can't tell a different story about your experience. Like, for example, if you go to a party and you try to talk about the end of capitalism, nobody will talk to you. Okay? You can talk about carbon fiber bicycles or NASA or whatever, but that's a sign of addiction. When there's a story you can't have, you see? Mm-hmm. So that's a sign that the imagination's shut down culturally, I think, you see? So we have to be on the lookout for that. So my understanding of nirvana is that it's the ability to change your mind and to see something from a completely new perspective, which then becomes a new story, and every story eventually becomes a bad story, and then we need to let that go also. And I think when Buddhist paradigms ratchet up the idea of not having any language and not having any stories as a state that we want, I think that it's helpful, but it's not a goal of practice. I would even say it's a byproduct of practice. So that's why tonight I'm trying to put in a word for the value of imagination, the value of stories. We need stories. So, let's notice the story about the story we tell of not wanting stories. Yeah. And say your name.
I'm Jenny. This isn't either of the questions I was about to ask.
Oh, okay,
it's,
great.
It's a response to the question in relation to what you've just said. So the spectrum from imagination to addiction is relative. It's quite an amazing idea. Mm-hmm. So that addiction is being stuck in repeating the same story. Mm-hmm. Imagination is being free to let new ones arise. Mm-hmm. That's on the individual level. Mm-hmm. What's the analogy on the social, political level, and is institutions getting stuck in oppressive practices? Is that the social equivalent of addiction, OCD?
Yeah. Sure. I mean, I can tell you a story about that if you want, which is, you know, I was very involved in the Occupy movement when it started in New York City, and you know, so one of the things that happened in the Occupy movement, even though the media reported it as a physical place, I really saw it as the creation of a space more than a place. And it was a space where... Let me give you an analogy. When you exhale and you finish your exhale, there's a place at the end of your exhale where there's really nothing there. There's not a thought there. If you really concentrate on the end of your exhale, there's a space where there's just the feeling of the end of the exhale and there's not a thought there. There's a letting go of thought. And I felt like the beginning of the Occupy movement was like a cultural exhale where we didn't know what to do next, but we knew one fact, that losses were being socialized and profits were being privatized. And nobody could disagree with that fact. Actually, I think the success of the Occupy movement was it allowed the media to talk about inequality in a way that hadn't been talked about. But what was interesting was that the media, which I thought of as like the ego, the storyteller, the media came in, and the media wanted two things. Violence, because you can't have a movement without violence, and demands. What are your demands? What do you want? And one of the things kind of in the inside of the Occupy movement was, let's not make any demands. First of all, we don't know how big this is going to get, so let's see what this is going to turn into. And secondly, we just need to exhale. Like, we need people to come together who've never collaborated to just share their story, because we see that the stories we're telling, they've run their course. And that's the addiction piece, right? It's run its course. The stories we're telling about success and economics and so on. And we didn't have a new story yet. And any meditator knows, or anyone who's experienced loss knows, you have to really grieve the loss of a story sometimes. without making a new one up. Sometimes you just don't know. And I thought the media was like the ego. Does this make sense? Like coming in going, like, give us a new story. Like, what do you want? You know? And that's just not what was happening. And it takes a lot of patience to be able to follow the end of the exhale. So my question is, if stories are so compulsive and so entertaining, and as meditators we all are working with knowing these patterns and also letting them go, then how do we scale that up and start to use that same insight to understand larger cultural narratives? And I think that area is fascinating, but I'm not smart enough to figure it out. But that to me is really interesting, is how do you scale up these insights we see individually?
And the way you talked about the Occupy movement, is this an example of what you meant by rebellion rather than revolution?
Yeah, I'm just uncomfortable with the word revolution because it's so ideological. Mm-hmm. And I'm using the word rebellion, and maybe it's not the right word, to talk, and I'm using the term embodied rebellion, to talk about a kind of moment-to-moment awareness, a moment-to-moment awakening that's social, and that isn't based on a belief system or an ideology. And I understand the Dharma in the same way also.
Thank you.
So, hopefully...
Can I ask one of the other questions?
Well, let me just let someone else speak, just because someone else should speak. what's your name?
My name's Kareem. My question, lots of people seem to be practicing mindfulness these days.
Yeah.
I wondered if you thought, if people are sitting and meditating, does that necessarily lead to this embodiment of values and turning towards social change? And if it doesn't, what are the other ingredients needed to take, to go from having a meditation practice to that turning towards what you've been talking about?
Well, I mean, the beginning of the Eightfold Path is appropriate view. And so I think you need to have a combination of meditation and the teachings. I mean, at one level, because I know many of you here do retreat practice, sometimes students come into retreats and they just like go really, really deep, really fast, and they get freaked out because they have no teachings, they have no understanding to kind of hold them, So I think the same is true with mindfulness practice. I think more and more mindfulness is being translated as paying attention. And that's not my experience of mindfulness. My experience of mindfulness is that it teaches us how to pay closer to attention to our motivations. It teaches us how to forgive. It teaches us how to be more generous. It's a religious practice. I mean religious in the best sense of that word. So my hope is that as mindfulness grows deeper in our culture, that it'll be connected to the teachings and the understanding, which also I think need to be articulated in a secular way, so that it has deeper roots and isn't just thinned out as, paying attention. Does that make sense? Yeah. And the interesting thing too is the younger your audience is with mindfulness, the more they want the teachings. Like parents are all freaked out that you have to make mindfulness in schools like super, super secular. But actually the kids like really want to know about the Buddha. They really want to know about death, And teenagers love hearing about ethics, actually. They don't care about meditating, but they love karma. Like that's the way in with teenagers. As you say to teenagers, okay, the core teaching is that your actions make a difference. That your actions actually have an effect. If you lie in your bed in a black room and listen to, Marilyn Manson all day, that's the effect you have. And kids just totally get that. So the teachings are just as important as the meditation, as the mindfulness. And I'm not trying to critique, you know, MBSR or anything like that. I think it's great, but with the teachings, it really together. Yes.
Yeah.
And will you say your name?
I'm Gary.
Okay, Gary.
Yeah, I'm just ties in with a question I was going to ask anyway.
Yeah.
It's sort of a continuation of what you're saying now. So I'm interested in that there's been such a hot debate in the last year,
yeah.
2 years I suppose now,
yeah.
David Loy among them,
yeah.
about is mindfulness basically quietism? In other words, does it encourage people who take
an
8-week course
yeah.
to just accept the way they're company works ethically in other ways
yeah.
in society, or can it lead to change? I think you're,
yeah.
I mean, perhaps you've got the point that
yeah.
it's not the 8-week course per se, but what it might lead to. But the point still remains that the majority of people who take secular mindfulness courses do 8 weeks, and they don't go on to examine
yeah.
the ethics
yeah.
or go into some form of Dharma practice.
Yeah.
And it's such a hot debate. Which is such, I mean, I think in a way you, it seems to me you've probably answered it, but I'm just wondering if that's your, if you have a view on it.
Well, a few years ago I asked Jon Kabat-Zinn this question, and he had a really good response. He said that they did a study where they studied why, when people finish the 8-week MBSR, mindfulness-based stress reduction course, why do some people continue meditating and some people don't? It's a great question. I don't remember the exact statistics, but overwhelmingly what they realized was that people who continued practicing were taught by somebody who had a meditation practice. Mm-hmm. And people who didn't continue practicing were taught by someone who didn't necessarily have a practice. In other words, we learn a lot more from unconscious communication than anything else. You can feel somebody's practice, I think. And the more that you practice, the more you can see it in other people. So that's one piece. The other piece is there's a Slovenian philosopher named Slavoj Žižek. Some of you may know his work. So last year he did a tour of American universities, and the topic of his talk was that Buddhism is the new opiate of the masses. And his critique, although I think he really needs some meditation practice, the critique is that when you turn inward and you close your eyes and you get calm and you get peaceful, then that's a perfect opportunity for the corporate state to just continue everything it's doing. And I think it's a valid criticism, but I also think it's not true. It's not the way I teach. It's not the way most people I know teach. But I think we also really have to listen to his concern, because I think it's something we need to continually look at. Some of you may have seen I gave a TED talk on this topic, talking about letting go of our intention to transcend in meditative practice. I feel like constantly this is what I'm trying to do, is articulate a Dharma practice that's not trying to turn inwards, and that's also not trying to get out of here. And people like David Loy do a very good job of this too. Yes. These are amazing questions. I mean, London is great. When I teach in Manchester, the questions are kind of... But in London, it's phenomenal. So I hope this is really good. Next time I come, if I'm ever invited back, I'm not even going to give a talk. We'll just talk together.
This just follows on from what you just said. Why do you think it is that corporations and businesses are taking up teaching the mindfulness of their employees and giving them apps?
As someone who just published an app, which is, you know, £2, you can get it. I don't know. Yeah, I wrote an article this year on Slate, a website called Slate. You can look it up. It's about Google and the U.S. military practicing mindfulness. And I wrote like a positional paper. So I... could say, just go look at that. But I do have to say something. You know, one thing is that, you know, I met a woman who teaches mindfulness in the military. If you don't know this, that this is the largest sector now of mindfulness in the United States. It's gone from medicine to education and now the military. And the way it's marketed is that we're helping veterans and we're helping soldiers with post-traumatic stress disorder. But actually, they're also teaching concentration practices to soldiers. And sometimes apologetically, I think, saying that actually many people are wounded on the battlefield because of friendly fire. So if we can have soldiers that are more meditative, they won't kill their own people. And in a way, you know, I don't know, maybe that's true, but I met a woman who was doing this work, and I said to her, if people practice mindfulness of breathing, and they are in touch with their body, and they do the four foundations of mindfulness, like mindfulness of breathing, mindfulness of sensations, of feelings, mindfulness of mental states, won't they not want to kill people? And she said, yes. So, I don't know. I mean, yeah, it was just interesting to hear that. Yeah, I mean, that was her perspective. She said, yes, when I teach them that, I think it reduces their intention to want to kill, reduces their anger. Now, my feeling and why I wrote this paper is it doesn't take into account at all the larger structure they're working under. And I think we need to take aim there a little bit also. But, you know, I'm not in the corporate world that much, so I can't say. But people are suffering. And I think that we all know this, and if it gets smuggled into a business, then that's a start. I could say other things too, but I also do feel that way. So we'll see. We'll see how this plays out over the long term. Hi. Yeah, I'm just going to check the time. Okay, we're good.
My name's Danny.
What's your name?
Danny.
Danny.
It's a question about something I thought I heard you say at the beginning, which I was just trying to clarify, which is, I think you said something like, we don't need to do inner work.
Oh, did I say that?
Or there's like something around not getting too stuck in inner work.
Yeah.
I was going to ask you if that's...
Oh.
If you said that, and if so, what did that mean?
I hope I didn't say that.
Wasn't it about doing stuff in your community that you didn't need to do, that you didn't need to sort yourself out first?
Oh, yeah. I said you don't have to do your inner work in order to do outer work. Like, for example, when I first started practicing, my teachers would say to me, first get enlightened, and then go help people. And I just don't believe that anymore.
So you're saying... You still need inner work, but just do it at the same time, inner work and outer work.
Yeah, if you try to do outer work, you really need inner work, because it involves other people. So what I want to try and get out of is privileging one over the other. And just trying to exit that model and say, like, we're always doing inner work and we're doing outer work. And the two are always synchronized. And the deeper you work with other people, the more you need to really look at your own prejudice and bias and habits and so on. And also, when we're going to do outer work, I think that there's just times in our life where we also just need to stop outer work and like really turn inwards and know what's true for us at that time. Because the hardest path still for any of us to take, I think, is into our own heart. Because we don't allow ourselves to have our own feelings. Like, we feel needy and we feel like, oh God, I shouldn't feel that. And I think that's one of the most difficult things in practice, is actually like to allow yourself to have your experience. And so that's what I think inner work is actually all about, is like looking at what blocks us from really having our experience. And I think that is something that may not be resolved through relational work. I think it's often something that we have to really like get stable and look closely, sweetly, with a lot of courage at our experience and allow ourselves to have our own experience.
But the point you're making, you don't need to do that.
But I don't need to.
Before you then go and do afterwards.
I don't think we need to have that model of you have to do it before in order to go do that. I think they can work together. And also, I don't know, when I was a young man, I sort of dropped out and just, like, I just wanted to get enlightened. So I just thought, well, the way you do it is you just go on retreat forever. And, like, I think a lot of young people, they don't do that anymore. Like, there's not as many people, I think, doing that anymore. Like, when I tell my story of how I practice, I don't see that as much anymore. But I also don't think that that's the only way. So, anyways, I think I responded without giving my whole biography away. So let's have two more. Is it okay, two more questions? We're supposed to finish at 9, it's 8:31. So that'll allow for two more questions and I can hang around a little bit. And then I have an app that puts me to sleep.
Yeah.
Hi, Mark.
I'm interested in this whole notion of not cooperating. Mm-hmm. I work with people in corporations, they're institutions that do violence to the people that work in them. Mm-hmm. Is it possible to invite people to stop cooperating when they're embedded in these systems, and there are risks for them in withdrawing their cooperation?
Well, you should answer that question, because you're in that world. I mean, what happens? What happens?
I explore the trade-offs with them. Where they need to lead them, you know. Sometimes their roads might be on a path of integrity. Sometimes they need to earn a living for their family. Mm-hmm. Leads them to step back. Mm-hmm. But it's easy for me to suggest they stop cooperating, because I've left the system. You know, I work outside it.
Yeah.
And this idea of doing inner work and the outer work at the same time is fine if you're doing inner work, but often the people in these institutions, they don't have that practice. Mm-hmm. And I'm loath to impose it on them.
Yeah.
Even invite them to do it. I feel they have to find it for themselves.
Sure. I think that if we go back to this idea that of modeling or unconscious communication, when you have those conversations with people, and sometimes even maybe push them a little bit, if they have your trust, there's something very deep that happens where they can see in you, I wonder how many people ask you about your story. Because when somebody has that direct conversation with you, and you have their trust, their life can inspire you a lot. So, and maybe some of that work at kind of top level happens one person at a time. Yeah. But you're a much better person to talk about that than I. Yeah. But the fact is, most of the people teaching the Dharma in the West now don't have robes. They're dressed like how we're dressed. And so I think we're smugglers, you know? And that's a really, really good thing. Because, like, early in Asia, you wore robes to disappear, to fit in. Now when you wear robes, you like really stand out. Like if I came here in robes, you'd really listen to what I was saying. It's one of the reasons why I stopped shaving my head. Is because when I was at the front of the room in Dharma circles with a shaved head, I always felt like people listened to me like so well. It adds an authority or something. So it's fun not to do that anymore. And I don't wear robes on purpose. And so I think we're like a new kind of military, a military of peacemakers. And we're smuggling a new set of values into the culture. But like you and many others, we have to do this faster. Yes?
I have a question.
Don't forget your name.
Oh, Katrina.
Okay.
And my question is actually quite related to what you just said, and it was about what your views are on communities. So in the beginning you said you just finished your community, and I was thinking, how did you just finish, you know? And, you know, where did it go? But also, what your view is on kind of on the need, or how much do you think do we not need the community to support us in our practice, especially living in a big city like this?
Yeah.
In a way, I would love to say that I'd love to be able to embody all this and be this completely on my own without the need for support. But what I found, the more I try and live within the big sort of society,
yeah.
It's just so easy to get caught up and then forget that you're really valuing.
Mm-hmm.
Being part of a meditative community helps a lot. But there's still kind of a divide, and I was just thinking what you thought and what happened to your community.
What happened to my community? Well, the first thing I'll say is I don't think we can do this without community. I really don't think so. So that's number one. That's the caveat, I guess. Okay, let me give you an honest answer. So when my youngest son turned one, before he turned one, I felt like as much as I loved running our community in Toronto, it was becoming exhausting. And we didn't have much infrastructure, and I feel like I wasn't getting enough support. And also, I've had a lifelong struggle with depression, and it kind of comes every like 5 or 6 years. And so I was starting to see myself kind of heading into a depression. I was totally exhausted. And simultaneously, I was so... And I think this is from my son being born. I felt like these issues that I've talked about tonight. I felt like we needed, as a Dharma community, to start thinking through how to address these issues with more clarity. And I felt like other people are really good at teaching meditation retreats. I love teaching meditation retreats. But like, I needed to free up some mental space. My partner's family lives on the west coast of Canada. So one day I was in their backyard and I was lying down, completely burnt out. And then my partner Karina came and said, "Sit up." I said, "Okay." She said, "I'm going to ask you a question and I want you to answer yes or no." I said, "Okay." She said, "Can we move out west closer to my family?" I said, "Okay, yes." And that was it. And we moved. And I also felt like it was kind of interesting leaving a community when things were growing and doing so well. Usually you leave when there's a catastrophe or something. And it was bittersweet. You know, I love all these people. We still stay in touch. They come on retreats. I do Skype calls with people. But just I'm one person, And I felt like in that structure, because of the way we were organized, and maybe some of my lack of training in this area, in leadership, you know, I felt like I just couldn't do it anymore physically. So that's one piece. And the other piece was, and I wanted to think about other things. Here I am, trying to work this out. So I don't know if I answered your question, but that's my story, and everybody will have a different story. When I was younger, I thought my career would be as a retreat teacher. And now I teach, you know, silent retreats, but I'm trying to do other things too. And I'm also really interested in reaching unconverted audiences, especially younger audiences too. And that's just my path. So there you go. Okay, one more. And that's it. But you already had a chance. So it has to be someone who hasn't spoken. It has to be amazing. Comment or question. One more. Okay.
It's not amazing, but yeah.
And you already told me your name, but remind me.
Paula.
Okay, Paula.
I really enjoyed the talk very much. It was a real good reminder of a lot of things that have come up in the last year. My specific question is, I work in international development, so I'm working in a sector where they really care about climate change and really care about economic inequality. Yeah. And so it's a really amazing space to be in, but what I see, and it was really interesting you pointed this out, was this degradation of intimacy, that there's a lot of competition in the development sector.
Yeah.
There's a real lack of connection. I think there's a real lack of an understanding of the personal still.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm trying to think about ways in which ways in which that can be reclaimed, because that's the place people were coming from, but you just see people working and then losing that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering what some of
because the culture is toxic.
Yeah, but, because donors encourage you to compete with each other and they don't encourage you to collaborate.
Yeah.
So, and for lots of reasons, but so I'm wondering, there's going to be a group of us who are starting to have these conversations, and we're going to start thinking about what might that look like to try and bring some of that back. But I'm not really sure how that might happen. Part of it might be through community, part of it might be through mindfulness trainings. But I just wonder if you have any ideas about, if you are trying to approach this from a sort of organizational sectoral perspective, what might be some of the ways in which that can sort of grow and be introduced and then grow in, on its own, but you know, how could a group of us kind of affect change? Might be some of those in.
Yeah.
Stories.
You know, maybe.
Yeah.
I mean, what she's talking about is trying to change the story of the culture, right?
Yeah.
And you know, again, maybe just go back to your own practice. And start, for example, like with the Eightfold Path. How would that work in the culture of your NGO or whatever? And just like
go through that process of thinking about the Eightfold Path.
Yeah, just be really creative. I mean, that's what I say to people is like, you know, I have lots of answers that I'd like to offer, more intellectual ideas, but you just have to make it up, you know? Like, we just did this practice with kids. This is totally different, but it's related, and just in terms of making it up. So I got invited to teach parents and kids about mindfulness. And so we made up this game, this tag. Do you have tag in England? Maybe you started tag. Freeze tag. Do you have freeze tag? So we had this game where, so the kids were in... So everybody, parents and kids, everyone, we're all playing. So somebody freezes, someone tags you, and you're frozen. So then how do you get unfrozen? One of the kids has to come and touch you and offer one of the slogans from the metta practice. So like they touch you and go, may you be happy. And then they run away and then you're unfrozen. I thought, oh, this would be a really fun game. We just kind of made it up. So we start playing it with the parents and kids. So then I didn't realize what would happen. So imagine this. So an adult is totally frozen. And you're like frozen. And then a kid comes up to you and touches you and says, may you be safe. And the adults will just start poor crying. And so their adults are just weeping. And the kids in small kids' voices, you know, so small, would touch the adults and say, may you be free from suffering. And it was just like this beautiful, nobody wanted the game to end. So I tell you that because, you know, once you start getting a feel for this practice, just make it up. Just invent it. Just be like, trust. This is what I mean about trusting your imagination. Just make it up. Everybody here has permission. You're all Dharma teachers. So, thank you very much for being here and for listening. And I know that for some of you, maybe you knew my work. Some of you, I'm a stranger. So I appreciate that you allowed me into your community. And it's a community I would love to learn more about. And this is just so wonderful, so beautiful. So thank you very much. If you're interested in learning more about my work, I have a website, which is just Michael Stone Teaching.